He masterminded the bloodiest day in Israel's history. 1 year on, 1 week later, comes news that Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas, has been killed in a firefight with Israeli soldiers. What happens next? Well, that's what we're going to be asking our panel. With us from Jerusalem, correspondent Iris Mockler. Thank you for being with us.
Pleasure.
From London, Nomi Bar-Yakov, associate fellow at the think tank Chatham House. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Francois. A pleasure.
From Washington, he is a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute. Hussein Ibish, welcome back for commenting this breaking news story.
Thank you.
And we're joined here in the set on studio by France 24's Philip Turrell from our international affairs desk. Good evening.
Good evening, Francois.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24 debate. Iris Mockler, confirmation coming through from the foreign minister of a firefight that took place in the Gaza Strip. We've seen photos emerge of Israeli soldiers taking a stretcher out in the southernmost city of Rafah, which is purported to be that of Yahya Sinwar. And we're waiting for Israel's prime minister to speak.
That's right. So I think that all of that together is a confirmation, but I actually have a real confirmation for you. And it came the old-fashioned way, fingerprints, not DNA. The DNA is still being tested. But the fact that the Prime Minister is going to speak, the fact that the fingerprints are those of Yahya Sinwar, confirms that the mastermind of the October the 7th attacks has been killed by Israel. It's important to say that the planning and the timing is believed of those attacks is believed to have been his. He was trained by Iranian forces with Hezbollah, but they were not informed of the date and the time, and that they were at the time quite surprised on October the 7th and said they didn't know about it. I was a bit doubtful, but I think when you look back and you see their behaviour, they really did not know about that date and that time. So it's a very significant, I'd actually say a seismic event in the conduct of the Gaza war. And we have heard that it was a firefight in the Gaza Strip. Ordinary soldiers, Francois, not elite forces, not based on intelligence, literally a firefight in Rafah in the south of the Gaza Strip. And when the three militants were killed, when the soldiers went back to see what was left or what had happened in that house to make sure that there was no one else there, no one coming up out of tunnels, there they found three bodies, one of them believed to be Yahya Sinwar, tonight confirmed to be Yahya Sinwar.
So can we speculate that it could be happenstance?
Well, it happenstance in the sense that definitely no planning, you know. It wasn't intelligence-based. It wasn't an elite unit sent in to do this. You'll remember the rescue of the hostages, Noah Argamani. There was weeks of planning in that. That wasn't the case this time. I guess happenstance is the right word, you know, an ordinary military operation in an area, by the way, where if you listen to pundits beforehand, Yahya Sinwar was no longer to be found. But nevertheless, there he was, not surrounded by hostages. The pundits and military officials had also suggested that he was surrounded by hostages. That turned out not to be the case.
Yeah, before October the 7th, much of the planet knew the names and faces of Hamas's political leadership in exile. That all changed when the native of Khan Yunis launched his attack. Jean-Emile Jamin has the story.
He was at the top of Israel's kill list, hunted since becoming the leader of Hamas in the Gaza Strip in 2017. After the death of Ismail Haniyeh in August, Yahya Sinwar was named as the militant group's new political chief at large. Born in a refugee camp in the southern Gazan city of Khan Yunis, Sinwar was a founding member of Hamas, establishing the group's military wing in the late 1980s. He was arrested and sentenced to four life terms in 1988, accused of orchestrating the abduction and murder of two Israeli soldiers and four suspected Palestinian informants. The 61-year-old would spend the next 20 years in Israeli prisons, but was one of 1,027 Palestinians released by Israel in a prisoner exchange deal in 2011.
It's really an indescribable feeling. There is no doubt that this is a nationalistic event par excellence.
It is one of the big strategic events in the history of our people's cause in the past years.
Post-release, Sinwar quickly rose through the ranks again, playing a political and military role during the seven-week Gaza war between Israel and Hamas in 2014. Elected Gaza Strip chief 7 years ago, Sinwar rarely appeared in public but kept a firm grip over the enclave. Sinwar was considered the architect behind the October 7th attacks, in which 1,200 Israelis were killed and 250 hostages taken into Gaza. The events quickly propelled Sinwar to Israeli public enemy number one. In deep hiding since then, he was believed to be sheltering in tunnels underneath Gaza, providing directives to Hamas. The Israeli military would openly reveal their aims should they ever encounter Sinwar.
The one who decided on this despicable attack was Yahya Sinwar, the sovereign of the Gaza Strip. Therefore, him and the whole system under him are as good as dead.
Yahya Sinwar was one of several people killed by an IDF operation on Thursday.
Noemi Bar Yaakov, when's the first time you can recall hearing the name of Yahya Sinwar?
Probably the release of Gilad Shalit. I mean, he was one of the prisoners that was released, and certainly there was some discussion about it, and I think that's my first recollection of when I heard his name.
Was this elusive figure. We had been all expecting, as Iris was saying at the outset, that there were all the speculation about him constantly being surrounded by hostages, and he's killed in an ordinary firefight. What does that tell you?
Well, I think one should ask, why did he move from the tunnel, into the ground? Was it that he felt that he needed to give orders on the ground to his troops, because Israel had eliminated many of the commanders of Hamas, including Mohammed Deif, who was in charge, was effectively the chief of staff. And I suspect that was the reason that he came up. He had the IDF and the US intelligence had lost track of him some weeks ago, and there were some speculations that because no one knew where he was, that he was potentially dead. But then, that proved not to be the case. He was surrounded by hostages for a long time. He was also surrounded himself by the six that were killed. So it's why he decided to move up, I certainly don't know, but that would be my guess, is that that's why he came out, in order to give orders and actually command things on the ground.
Hussein Ibish, we've lost the connection with Hussein Ibish, but we can welcome at this point Palestinian academic Ahmed Fuad Al-Khatib, non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council think tank, who joins us from Washington. Thank you for being with us here on France 24. First off, your reaction to the news.
Thanks for having me. For the record, I'm a resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. I was honestly quite surprised by this development on a variety of fronts. I was of the belief that Sinwar is very much so hiding in the tunnels underneath Gaza. I think the fact that he has been coming out and moving with a small team is indicative of how difficult it has been for him to relay messages to field commanders, to maintain leadership over the disparate cells of Hamas. We know that Hamas today is severely weakened. They do not have the type of internal communications and hierarchy that they once did. So this actually, if anything, to me, is indicative of the desperate conditions of Hamas's leadership and the difficulty of maintaining control over the different cells. I think this development, it was unexpected for the Israelis to, as you said, for him to die in a firefight like this, rather than what we expected of him being surrounded by hostages in tunnels, and him leveraging the massive sprawling underground network that Hamas has spent years and billions of dollars building. I think this opens a lot of opportunities and off-ramps for both Hamas itself, but most importantly for the Israeli government, to try and create an opening with Arab and international support to bring the war in Gaza to an end.
I want to get to that point in one second, but first I want to ask Hussein Ibish, who's back on the line. Hussein, Hamas has had several lives since the days of Sheikh Yassin. I guess the question is, what did Yahya Sinwar incarnate?
Well, he incarnated the victory, political victory, of the gunmen on the ground who had fought the wars with Israel in the past 15 or 20 years. The political bureau that used to run Hamas before his rise, and that of the Qassam Brigade leader, also dead now, Mohammed Daif, had been, you know, suited people who were politicians. They had to flee Gaza in a deal with Israel, went to Syria. During the Syrian uprising, because the Muslim Brotherhood, of which they were the Palestinian version, was a key part of the uprising against Assad, they then fled to Qatar, and they became further and further away from Gaza and from the Hamas boots on the ground, giving Sinwar and the others the chance to seize de facto power and orchestrate October 7th, and then when Haniyeh was killed, to seize titular power. So he represented the victory of the hardliners, the gunmen, the fighters, the guys with blood on their hands, as opposed to the people that he referred to as the hotel guys, because they live in posh hotels in Qatar or Turkey or even Lebanon, not in tunnels or on the battlefields of Gaza.
So if the gunmen, then I turn back to Ahmed Fuad al-Khatib on this, if the gunmen are in charge inside of Hamas, how does that bode for the chances of some kind of a settlement where the war can end?
Now is that if this moment is not seized upon with mass offers of amnesty and incentives, financial and otherwise, to the remaining fighters, cadre of fighters throughout Gaza, there could be an a bad opportunity for some of these splinter cells to mutate into a more hardline, deadly threat that keeps the war going, that refuses to release the hostages. What I worry about is what sort of scenarios did Sinwar put in place for his eventual death? Because he knew he was a dead man walking. Are we going to see some kind of a dramatic display of, for example, an execution of some of the hostages or some attacks that Hamas has prepared to show that they're intending to keep fighting and to keep going? I agree with my previous colleague before in that Sinwar's rise to power formulated a bridge, basically, for the hardliners, for the militants, for the gunmen to actually gain power on the ground, to actually have their voice be front and center in Hamas's political strategies and discussions. But I think right now Hamas is so deeply weakened that Sinwar's death and his demise may, in fact, incentivize a few of the fighters on the ground to realize that it's a lost cause, it's a lost, hopeless battle, so, and that their best option is to surrender.
And so you're saying there's a window of opportunity as well on the Palestinian side for less hardline elements?
Precisely that. I think there are some within Hamas, even in the Qassam brigades, and I follow this through social media. I follow this. I mean, I'll be honest with you. In 2017, I actually spoke to Sinwar personally for 40 minutes. I was running an international NGO to build an airport in the Gaza Strip. And through an intermediary, I had a 40-minute WhatsApp phone call with him. And I remember how the idea was to get him to agree to Hamas not obstructing the presence of an internationally run IDF-approved facility. So I've tracked Sinwar very closely for years, and I've tracked those on his periphery. Sinwar of 2017 was far more, I would say, I hate to use this word, moderate and reasonable than Sinwar of 2022 and 2023. It was actually in 2017 that he began repairing Hamas's relationship with Iran. Remember when Khalid Mish'al went against Iran by supporting the Syrian opposition and the revolution, and Iran and Hezbollah had a falling out? It was Sinwar who, beginning in 2017, felt that he was running up against the wall, that Hamas's cause was hopeless without the armaments and the financial support of Iran. But he was actually, he displayed, when I spoke to Sinwar in 2017, he displayed interest in letting Gaza develop while Hamas could, in parallel, pursue a political agenda. And remember, 2017 was the year that Hamas changed its manifesto, changed its constitution, if you will, to be a little bit less anti-Semitic and less hardline. Sinwar believed that that was the last chance to try and engage in a political program, but he felt through the hardliners around him, through the militants, through Deif and Marwan Issa and some of the other leaders that were later assassinated, that Hamas's sole raison d'etre is the armed resistance narrative. And that's why he chose to repair the relationship with Iran. So I think there is an opportunity right now, again, through incentives. But I also worry that if this opportunity is not seized, there's the risk that Hamas, or what remains of it in Gaza, could mutate into a far deadlier menace to the Palestinians and Israelis.
Nomi Bar Yaakov, if you're a betting woman, would you wager that Israel's government would want to seize the opportunity described there by Ahmed?
Well, first of all, let me agree with Ahmed Fuad El-Khatib. I think, you know, his analysis was spot on. And I think that the only way that Israel may consider agreeing to seize the moment and get all the hostages released and get a more moderate Palestinian government that can actually govern Gaza for the benefit of the Palestinian people and the Israelis is if the US would exercise its leverage. It's long overdue, but President Biden doesn't have many days to do it before the 5th of November. But he actually, you know, and it's urgent because they could kill hostages. So it's very, very urgent for the US to exercise the leverage, to put on the table a deal that is a sort of all or nothing, take it or leave it, with, of course, Qatar and Egypt. And I couldn't stress more how urgent this is, given that if hostages will be executed, everything will go down, spiral downhill. So I wouldn't want to bet on it, but I would like to urge the US to take urgent action.
We're getting statements in from Israel's Prime Minister, Naomi Bar Yaakov, saying the evil, quote, has been delivered a blow, but our task is not complete. Your thoughts?
My thoughts are is predictable. I mean, Netanyahu is predictable, and he'd like to extend the war and the wars, meaning both Gaza and the West Bank and Lebanon and Iran. So I stress the only way to stop Netanyahu and the wars is for the US to exercise the leverage that it has and inflict a cost on Israel. If the answer is no, they need to have a take it or leave it deal. And the leave it has to bear very serious consequences. And I think they're capable of it and they need to do it.
Hussein Ibish, we've seen the sometimes lack of pushback from the United States. Yeah. You've discussed it on this show for now more than 12 months. This announcement comes in a week, though, where the U.S. has been more forceful than in the past, this over delivering aid to civilians in Gaza. What are the chances, 2 weeks and 5 days out from a U.S. presidential election, that the Biden administration would twist Netanyahu's arm?
Well, I know they've been preparing a potential day after take it or leave it deal for immediately after the election, assuming a Harris victory, because, you know, if there's a Trump victory, Netanyahu will just ignore it, I think, with impunity, counting on the fact that Biden will go on January 20th. If Harris is elected, I think they're likely to put a deal like that on the table. But I don't think Netanyahu is likely to accept it then. Now, they've been using two elements, carrots and sticks, right, to influence Israel's policies in the past week. The carrots have been the SAD anti-missile system and other anti-missile systems that have been deployed in great numbers and at great expense to make up for the fact that the Arrow system didn't seem to really perform adequately against Iran's ballistic missiles, even though little damage was done. That was probably due more to the dumb bomb quality of the Iranian projectiles. They, by luck, just hit wherever they hit. and didn't actually do anything dramatic, but again, they might have. So this is an inducement that gives the United States a positive influence on saying, we'll protect you, but don't hit Iran's oil facilities and shoot the price of oil up right before an election, and don't hit Iran's nuclear facilities to spark a regional war or to make, you know, greatly escalate things, and also make Iran sprint towards a bomb, which is the likely reaction to that. And then they've had this threat, the stick, with potentially withholding munitions, which Israel needs, extending a lot of them, especially in Lebanon now. It needs them to be re-upped by the United States, and the U.S. is putting very specific humanitarian numbers and giving the Israelis 30 days to comply. So that's a stick. The missile defense is a carrot. They're using them. But I don't think the Biden administration is going to move on a day after take it or leave it scenario until after November 5th.
Until after.
And after they think Harris has won.
All right. So that gives the Israeli Prime Minister, Iris Makler, 2 weeks and 5 days. Benjamin Netanyahu says the war is still not over in those remarks that he's been making. Iris, so if the pressure won't come from Israel's greatest ally, will it come domestically as we speak in Tel Aviv, a rally of the families of hostages calling on the government to leverage the killing of Yahya Sinwar to secure an immediate deal for those 101 still believed to be held captive in the Gaza Strip?
That's right. There is pressure from the ground up, as there has been throughout this war, it has to be said. The families of the hostages, I've seen them from the time there was speculation about this killing of Yahya Sinwar. I've seen them both really terrified, I would say, that there might be a speeding up in the killing of hostages, that as one of them said, yeah, this is very good news, I still don't see my daughter, where is she? So there is that kind of pressure. But interestingly, I'm seeing reported tonight a different kind of spirit coming from the government. This is the diplomatic reporters who have access to very high levels of government. Levels of government I don't have access to. And what they've been saying is this. There was a letter that was sent out to 100 foreign ministers by Israel's foreign minister before there actually was even an official confirmation, saying Yahya Sinwar is dead. We want a hostage deal. We need your help. Now is the time. So that's quite an interesting proactive step. And all the pundits that I've been hearing speaking tonight say that now is the time for action. It's not what you're hearing from right-wing commentators, but it is what you're hearing from centrist commentators. Even people who have quite extremist views have been saying now, you know, if you have a victory, you have to pursue it. You have to take advantage of it. You have to take advantage of the chaos in Gaza, and you have to push for a hostage deal and or an end to this war, but definitely a hostage deal because, you know, it is a turning point.
Yeah, but
and if you take it with both hands, if you have the will, then you could take it with both hands.
Because, Iris, you've been gauging the size of the crowds, and they've grown at times over the past 12-plus months, calling for the return of the hostages. But they've never been, as you've been reporting, the size of the crowds we saw when there was that attempt by the coalition government led by Benjamin Netanyahu for that judicial overhaul.
There was one day that there were very, very large crowds, and that was after they found the bodies of the six hostages. By the way, another happenstance event. You know, they weren't going there to rescue them. They found their bodies, six hostages executed by Hamas when they saw that the Israeli troops were getting nearer. And then there were hundreds of thousands of Israelis on the street. So there was a feeling that the military, Israel's military action wasn't producing the results that were promised, which was, you know, the hostages would be freed this way, and in fact was endangering the hostages. Since then, it's been more, you know, the numbers have gone down. There's been the start of a war in Lebanon. It's very hard to protest in large numbers against your own government when it's fighting on two fronts. Then there were the Iranian attacks. So the protests have gone off the boil. But I don't think that means the concern for the hostages has gone off the boil. And I think that if you ask any ordinary Israeli, I was speaking to someone who goes to synagogue here, quite a religious man, and he said that You just had to mention the hostages in the New Year's prayers and people were in tears. So I think there is a general view inside Israel that this war has gone on long enough without the remaining hostages returning, and that so many of them have died during the course of this 12 months and 1 week.
And that worst case scenario that was evoked there earlier by Ahmed Fuad al-Khatib, where Yahya Sinwar knew he was a marked man and may have been preparing for executions of hostages. Is that a concern this evening in Tel Aviv where they're rallying?
Yes, I think it's a very serious concern. And I think,
Go ahead, Naomi Bar-Yakov.
Asking Iris or me, I apologize.
Go ahead, Naomi Bar-Yakov.
I'm so sorry. I think it is a very serious concern, and that's why I stress the urgency. I think it is absolutely urgent to reach a ceasefire deal and release all the hostages. And I stress again, all the hostages, because there is no reason not to do it now. Netanyahu will try to drag the wars on, but I reiterate, there are states, including the United States, and principally the United States, that have the leverage and can do it.
Philip Turrell, we were speaking earlier with our Europe editor, Armin Georgian. This is all happening while an EU summit's taking place in Brussels. And what Armin was telling us was that European states are, well, divided.
I think there's definitely a feeling that Israel has a right to defend itself. I think everyone would back that. But when it comes to what is happening on the ground, there is dissension between some countries and others. I think a lot of people in Europe don't really understand the position of the United States. They don't understand why so many weapons are still being delivered to Israel that are being used straight away in the war, not only in the Gaza Strip, but also in Lebanon. And there have been calls for restraint, which are falling on deaf ears in the US ahead of a presidential election, and not taking any notice from the part of the Israelis. And there have been phone calls this week between Emmanuel Macron and Benjamin Netanyahu, which have been pretty shirty between the two leaders, with Macron saying that it was time to stop the war, to rein things in, and Benjamin Netanyahu more or less saying, well, you know, I'm in charge, it's me who makes the decisions, and you're not the one who should be telling me what to do. Incomprehension, anger and disappointment. And looking at the statements tonight from Benjamin Netanyahu, just noting down what he's been saying in the last few minutes, it doesn't look as though in his mind he's moving towards a ceasefire anytime soon. He says, evil's been delivered a blow, but our task is not complete. We will continue full force until our hostages are returned. Sinwar has ruined the lives of the people in Gaza. This is an opportunity for Gaza's people to free themselves from Hamas's tyranny. The war is still not over. The Middle East light is prevailing over darkness. The region has the opportunity to stop the axis of evil and to bring peace and prosperity to the Middle East. But it doesn't sound like that's a statement from someone who wants to immediately move towards a ceasefire or wants to immediately try to get those hostages to free. We will continue full force in the Middle East in that war. It's more like, I'm going to carry on with this war, even though we've managed to knock out Yahya Sinwar.
Iris Makler, one final point on this. We've said it time and again, why would you, politically speaking, if you're very cynical, why would you want to end a war if you know that the day after there's going to be a commission of inquiry into the security lapses on October the 7th?
There is that, but you know, there are other fronts now. If you end the war in Gaza, you can still keep fighting in Lebanon, and indeed there's something that hasn't been closed with Iran. So perhaps the commission of inquiry can be pushed back a bit. There is also that. I say that cynically, of course, but there is that. And I want to say one thing about Benjamin Netanyahu's speech tonight. I think, as with most of his speeches, his audience is his base, very like Donald Trump in that sense. It doesn't necessarily mean that there won't be negotiations just because he's speaking in that way. That's for home consumption. And then what then transpires with a negotiating team might be different. And it might be different only because this is a turning point, you know, not because I have faith that this right-wing government necessarily wants to end this war, but sometimes an opportunity presents itself that you must take up.
Ahmed Fuad al-Khatib, negotiate with who? What Hussein Ibish quoted the late Yahya Sinwar saying, the hotel guys, the ones that are in Qatar. Are there other people inside of the Gaza Strip whom the Israelis could negotiate with?
Well, I think that's going to be the interesting thing to watch for over the next few days is, can the hotel guys, can, I'm looking at four names that are of interest. There's Musa Abu Marzouk, there's Khalil Al-Hayya, there's Khalid Mish'al, and then there's Osama Hamdan. Those are the four most likely successors to Sinwar as political heads of the organization. It'll be interesting to see, I believe within Hamas, the ethos is one of obedience to the leadership. And if one of those guys, even though they may not have the legitimacy among some of the armed fighters on the ground, they can still nevertheless push for a broader deal, a stand down, if you will, of a sort, a unilateral ceasefire that Hamas can implement. So I wouldn't entirely discount Hamas's the capabilities of Hamas's foreign leadership to actually implement some or push their rank and file to accept a ceasefire of a sort. So I think now the ball is in the Israeli court, really. I think Hamas is weakened. Hamas is probably desperate for something to retain a presence on the ground in Gaza, or at the very least, political relevance. And what concerns me about the message of Prime Minister Netanyahu, I understand he's talking to his base. Nevertheless, I've not seen any indication from him or Israeli leadership about what the parameters of this total victory that he's calling describing are. I mean, is it a matter of going after every single remaining Hamas member on the ground? I mean, including insignificant rank and file members. Is it a matter of getting the hostages released? Is it getting Hamas fully dismantled, which we know they're not really capable of governing Gaza? That's why we need to push for a ceasefire and a hostage deal.
So
let me ask you
on that score, Ahmed. Axios news agency in the United States, the one that leaked that letter that the Defense Department sent to Israel about letting more aid into Gaza or else they would stop deliveries in a month. They're reporting that the United States Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has been speaking with Qatar's prime minister about negotiations on a hostage deal and about Sinwar's killing. Is that just more noise or is something happening?
Well, I actually think Sinwar may have been holding back some of the more reasonable, in quotes, and moderate elements within Hamas who see the disaster and the writing on the wall and don't hold the messianic, grandiose planning that he wanted, which is to keep the war going on as long as possible. He was very much so an obstacle to reaching a ceasefire and a hostage deal. So there may emerge some mid-level commanders within Gaza who could actually force the rank and file to turn over the hostages, to order a stand down. There could be an opportunity right now, and I commend the United States for pushing the Qataris to exercise pressure on Hamas. But we also need pressure on the other direction in terms of the Israeli leadership feeling that we need to seize the moment to end the war in the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, and we could see those images again of from Tel Aviv, rally of families of hostages. Ahmed Fuad al-Khatib, you're from Gaza. Your thoughts on what was happening when the news first started to break? It's been a day of fierce fighting. There's been at least 50 Palestinians killed across the Gaza Strip. Fierce fighting in the Jabalia refugee camp near Gaza City. The Israeli army targeting a school, saying it was housing Hamas and Islamic jihadist jihad fighters, children among those killed. Your thoughts on, you know, every time we say, oh, well, the fighting is dying down, it seems to spark up again.
Unfortunately, there are splinter cells of Hamas that continue to have access to munitions they've stored in their tunnels, that continue to act independent of the broader dynamics of the conflict of the war. Those guys will need explicit orders by senior leadership, whether they be political or military, to stand down, potentially to demobilize. We also need to
realize they will listen to a Khaled Mash'al in Doha.
I think if Khaled Mishaal can frame it as this is what's good for Hamas, this is your salvation, this is going to keep us alive and keep us relevant, they absolutely will. Because a lot of these guys, they're tired themselves. They haven't had any salaries, any access to their families, any access to real healthcare or food, except for what they steal from trucks every now and then. So I actually think Hamas is vulnerable. Hamas is weakened. But the situation on the ground is horrendous. What's happening in the north? I still have immediate and extended family members in the Gaza Strip. I have folks in the north that my surviving two uncles, my dad's middle brothers. We've lost contact with them for months now. And I grew up the family home that was destroyed almost a year ago by Israeli airstrikes, killing my 12-year-old niece and injuring almost 30 of my immediate and extended family members. That was right next to Jabalia. We lived in Sheikh Radwan, which was right next to the Jabalia camp. My father ran the Jabalia refugee clinic for UNRWA, the United Nations Refugee and Works Agency. I'm well aware of the suffering that is happening on the ground, and that's why we need to end this war. Unfortunately, Hamas under Sinwar has become so callous to the suffering of the people, of everyday people, and the people of Gaza are fending for themselves. That's why I've actually been observing what I would dare to say, and I'm willing to put my reputation on the line and call it mass jubilation among Palestinians on Arabic social media, on Telegram channels, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, who are absolutely delighted to see Sinwar gone. They hold him personally responsible for launching a destructive war of annihilation, for serving them on a silver platter to the most extremist right-wing government in Israel's history. Sinwar was not a man of charisma. He was not well-loved by Gazans. He was known as somebody who was nihilistic for the duration of this war since October 7th. There have been memes and videos of his statements from the past 3 to 5 years of him saying, "We will all burn to the last child before we surrender. We will all die before we back down." Him making it clear that he views Gazans as expendable, that their sacrifices and martyrdom are necessary for his nefarious intentions. So the people of Gaza are, on the one hand, happy that the butcher who led them into this massacre and disaster is gone. On the other hand, they're desperate to see Israeli airstrikes stop. They're desperate to see Israeli incursions. They're stuck between a relentless, ferocious, merciless Israeli war machine and a despicable, disgusting terror organization that effectively uses them as human shields and hides amongst them.
Hussein Ibish, it's been a day when we've had more fighting in the south of Lebanon. The war has expanded in the recent weeks. This could go either way. Is this an opportunity, or are we going to see just more escalation ahead?
Well, it's an opportunity, but it's very unlikely to be fulfilled, I think, by either side. Of course, everything Ahmed said is exactly correct. And if you did somehow see the rise of someone like Moussa Abu Marzouk, who's probably the most forthcoming of the Hamas leaders external as a new political power in the group, you might see them taking some serious steps. It's also possible that the illumination of the top command might bring in a new leadership on the ground that, as Ahmed said, is exhausted and is ready to maybe try to rebuild. And to rebuild, they need to stop the war. But more likely, Hamas is prepared to continue the insurgency that Sinwar was trying to spark with the October 7 attack. The war that ended when the Rafah campaign was completed, the war against organized Hamas, against Hamas as a governing force in Gaza, against the organized brigade, that was Israel's war. But the war that has begun after that, the insurgency that's going on today, that Israel doesn't know what to do about other than starve everyone, force everyone out of an area, declare everyone in the northern third of Gaza a combatant worthy of death. This is what they're talking about. That is Hamas's war. And so I think Hamas is finally fighting the war that Sinwar imagined. And it's a long game. He's thinking 10, 20, 30 years down the line. And what they want is leadership of the Palestinian National Movement. They want to wave the bloody shirt and say, "We are the ones fighting the Israelis every day. And they're thinking it'll take a long time for that message to deliver them the kind of national leadership they want. They want to marginalize Fatah and be the sole voice of the Palestinian people, or the main voice anyway, and ultimately speak in the name of the PLO for the state of Palestine in the General Assembly, at the ICC and ICJ, and all the different multinational organizations, at the Arab League and in all these embassies. That's what they want. And as I said, I think they're playing a long game, and I think they're likely to want to continue playing it. I think the voices that are saying in Qatar and elsewhere, the Hamas voices that have been saying mostly privately, hey, this is crazy. We're throwing away everything we built since 2007. This is nuts, have been absolutely eclipsed. And I don't expect them to regain the momentum now just because Yahya Sinwar is gone. I hope they do. And I think there is an opportunity that Ahmed described really well. But I'm very skeptical, extremely skeptical, especially since Israel is going through, obviously, if Netanyahu is anything to judge by, and we ought to listen to him, it has no intention of stopping the war. And I don't think Hamas at this point is going to want to do that either.
Very briefly, because we're out of time, Iris Makler, Benjamin Netanyahu stating, if hostage takers release captives, they will live. Your thoughts on that?
I think that there is a sense in the Israeli government, from what I've been hearing tonight, that this is a turning point, and that whether this right-wing government can take it, I'm not confident. I wouldn't predict that. But even that statement is a sign that force with one hand is always the Netanyahu style, especially when he's speaking to his base, and that I'm minded to be optimistic.
All right, connection there, dropping out, unfortunately. The joys of live television on this breaking news story. Iris Makler in Jerusalem. I want to thank Hussein Ibish and Ahmed Fuad Al-Khatib in Washington. Nomi Bar Yaakob for being with us from London. Philip Turrell, thank you for being with us here in this special edition of the France 24 debate.